I'm sorry I said you were crazy, little ghost.
Kestrel remembered how it felt to lose to her father at Bite and Sting, at Borderlands, at anything he chose to play. The dig at her pride. The hurt certainty that she'd never be able to prove herself to him. Embarrassment for wanting to prove herself. She remembered her hands clinging to his jacket, her whole self reduced to two claws as she pleaded with him. War wasn't a game, but she wanted badly to make her father know how it felt to lose. Roshara said,
"Tell me what you need."
"A horse. Javelin might be recognized. Probably not. I don't intend for the horse to be seen, but better not risk it. And I want to get there while it's still dark. Scouts run on foot, so I'll have to tether the horse at a distance from the station. As for the station..."
"You need the location."
"And the scout's gear." Roshara clicked his teeth, a chastising sort of sound.
"The gear is easy. If you want the location of the scout's camp, we need to revisit our conversation this afternoon about not-so-nice means of extracting valuable information."
"Don't."
"I don't enjoy it, but she's not likely to tell us just because we ask nicely."
"You can't." He drew an impatient breath, and she knew what he'd say, knew the arguments, the costs and benefits. She knew that Roshara, with his mutilated face, understood what it was like to be subjected to pain. She wanted to say all this before he did, and to find a convincing reason that he was wrong. There was no reason she thought he'd accept. She couldn't think of another way. Then she did.
"Don't do it. Trick her instead."
Roshara squinted.
"Explain."
"When Valorians enlist, they do so partly because of friendships. There are lovers in a camp. Even without that, there is a sense of belonging. People you'd die for and do anything to protect. She'll have someone she cares about among the scouts. Take her token. Cast it with a mold. A bit of soap, maybe, or wax. Melt down metal to match the token and make a new one. Return hers. Show her the other one. Say you found its mate on another scout who claims to be her friend. Promise to torture her fellow scout if she doesn't give up the location of the officer."
"She might care more about the officer than this other scout."
"Try."
He shrugged, then nodded.
"I hope that in your bag of delightful schemes, you have one for how to deal with Arryn."
"No."
"Dear ghost, he will tie you and me up and dump us both into a very deep hole before he allows you to do what you plan to do."
"No more allowing," Kestrel said. "And no more lies."
24. Arryn woke to the sound of screams. He shoved out of his tent and into the night, but the camp was calm, undisturbed, though soldiers near their fires seemed to have stopped in mid-conversation to eye the tent, from which the screams came and then choked off into a sob. Arryn asked the whereabouts of the prince and was directed to a nearby tree, where Roshara leaned over the bound Valorian scout, hissing a threat too low for Arryn to understand. The Valorian girl, just a girl, Arryn saw, younger than Kestrel, had her eyes squeezed shut. She strained back against the tree, bare heels digging into the dirt and moss. She wore an eastern tunic and trousers. A bandage on her arm was rusted with blood. She opened her eyes, glazed with fear, darting all over, skittering across Arryn's face as he froze. How wide they were, how dark, how like the eyes of the woman he'd killed on the ship. Another scream broke the night. It came again from the tent. Arryn strode to the prince.
"Roshara, a word?"
"I was wondering when you'd join the fun," the prince answered in Valorian. He grinned at the girl.
"I'll be back."
When they were out of earshot of the scout, Roshara dropped his smile.
"To be clear, this was Kestrel's idea."
"What the hell are you doing?"
"Faking a torture."
Arryn thought he understood and calmed down a little.
"Is it working?" "It might, if you don't interrupt again."
"Let me know if you learn something."
"Of course."
"Where's Kestrel?"
"She wants to be alone right now,"
Roshara said after a slight pause.
"Better let her be."
But Roshara's tone made Arryn remember how the prince had smiled at him, the reins of two horses in his hands on the grounds of Arryn's home. This made him think of Kestrel's refusal earlier, before nightfall, to make him any promises. Ever since the sun had gone down, Aaron's nerves had tightened with anxiety, even as he'd warned himself not to push things, to be different from how he usually was, to not overreact or feel too much or say too much. Let her be, he'd told himself, exactly as Rishara was telling him now. But another scream rose in the distance, and even though Aaron knew that this was a trick, it was Kestrel's trick. Her tricks tended to be shaped like a nest, each twig and straw in place, hiding a dangerous creature Aaron never saw until it was too late. Aaron said,
"Where is she?"
Reluctantly, the prince said,
"She hasn't left yet."
"Left? What? Where?"
"Ask her. She'll tell you. Against my better judgment, I might add."
Rishar nodded in the direction of his tent. Aaron took one rapid stride toward it. The prince's hand came down hard on his shoulder.
"Aaron, her plan is a good plan."
Aaron shrugged off his grip and walked away. He found her sitting on Rishar's cot, lacing up high Valorian boots. She wore trousers, the scout's trousers. Kestrel had bound her breasts with tight cloth. Her midriff was bare, her shoulders and arms too, skin a dark gold, fired by the lamplight. She'd heard him enter, yet kept her head down, ignoring him, her braid hanging heavily over one shoulder. It swayed slightly as she jerked laces over the boots' hooks and cinched them. When she reached for the Valorian tunic and jacket on the cot beside her, he caught the trace of a mottled line on her shoulder, saw the lash that curled up over her neck. She paused. Had she heard the sore thump of his heart? Or the way he'd swallowed, caught in the nightmare of those scars, in the memory of seeing them for the first time, in his awful imagining of how they'd been made? She stood and turned her back to him. Just before she drew the tunic over her head, he saw almost the full maze of marks, white and raised. She put on the earth-colored jacket. All the scout's clothing dyed to match the woods.
"Kestrel?"
His voice was rough. She faced him and told him her plan. When he started to argue, he couldn't even hear what he said. His pulse was shuddering, the blood draining from him. She said, "Trust me." He did. He wanted to say so, then realized that he didn't, that he could not and would not if trusting her meant this.
"No."
She was angry now, too.
"You can't keep me in a cage."
"I'm not."
Yet that was what he meant to do, in a way. Even as he saw the wrongness of that, he couldn't imagine letting her go.
"It's too dangerous."
She shrugged.
"Why do you insist on risking yourself? You were caught once. You're not infallible. Are you trying to prove that you are?"
"No."
"Are you trying to punish me?"
"No."
"I deserve it, I know, but..."
"This isn't about you.
You're going to get caught."
"I don't think so."
"You'll be killed. Worse. I can't..."
"Yes, you can. You had better."
"Why?"
"Because this is me."
Her eyes were wet.
"This is the sort of person I've always been."
He wanted to tell her that wasn't true.
"You remember wrong," he could say.
And this time he'd be the one who was a good liar. Kestrel said,
"I want to be like her."
"No, you don't," he'd persuade,
even though he'd never been able to bear the way she thought of herself as two people. "Not like her at all." His stomach curled.
"Am I the only one who's supposed to worry?" she asked. "As I did when you went to sea. As I will tomorrow. Every day after that. You can worry for me like I worry for you."
He looked at his hands. They trembled.
"Trust me," she repeated.
He felt the misery of his fear, the desperate certainty that he would lose her again. He trusted that certainty. He trusted his fear. It ruled him like a god.
"Aaron,"
he met her eyes. They were strange and familiar, rich in his mind, with everything he knew about her and with the mystery of her thoughts, which he'd never know for sure. He saw. The knowledge cracked open his shell of fear that death wasn't the only way to lose her. He would lose her if he couldn't do this. He didn't trust her. He did not. Yet he understood that there are some things you feel and others that you choose to feel, and that the choice doesn't make the feeling less valid.
Do you?
She asked. He made his choice.
Yes.
She stepped into his arms. He held the rope of her braid gently. He was drowning. He was far below the surface. He'd forgotten how to breathe. Then his lungs opened and his mind grew quiet and clear.
Come back to me, he murmured.
I will. 25. She rode hard. Crouching low over the saddle, Kestrel pressed the horse to a gallop, drove it straight down the main road from Aerolith to the south. The map was in her mind. She saw again the shaky mark made on a forest 2 leagues from the general's camp. Roshar had brought the map to her with the scout's token. And now, the clatter of hooves, a cream of sweat on the horse's neck, wan moonlight, hard to see pits and cracks in the road. If the horse stumbled at this pace, it'd shatter a bone, toss its rider. Kestrel would break her neck on the paving stones. She dug her heels in. She'd mere hours before the sky blued and lightened. There'd be no chance then to pretend to be the scout. Black trees jolted and wavered on either side of the road. Her throat was dry. Sweat salted her lips. She remembered Aaron's hand slipping down the length of her braid, letting go, the way he'd looked at her. The trees gave way abruptly to grass and seemed to topple back, crash noiselessly behind her as she sped forward. The horse's stride lengthened along the meadow. It felt like she rode over a black sea. A smudge of trees in the distance. West. Off the road now, slower, cantering over the meadow toward the western forest. She let the horse walk, felt its sides bellow and heave against her legs. Low branches to duck under. Watch the knees. The trees grew close together. No path here. Straining to see through different shades of shadow, Kestrel picked a way through the woods until it didn't make sense anymore to ride. It was when she tethered the horse. There was no sound of fresh water, and that was cruel. She hated to leave the horse like that, neck drooping, coat furred with sweat, that Kestrel first felt it. A slow fear, heavy, like sadness, which made her realize that her fear was a kind of sadness, because she couldn't be better than her fear. She had believed that she could be better when she'd stood before Aaron and demanded that he trust her. When she felt, finally, the truth of his trust, warm and solid in his long limbs. But this was how it ended, her, alone, stepping through the woods, afraid. She paused, tipped her head back, and glanced up at the sharp stars.
"See how brave they are,"
whispered the memory of her father's voice. She'd been very young when he'd said this.
"Bright and still. Those stars are the kind of soldiers who stand and fight."
A rush of anger. Even the stars. "Don't just stand there," she told herself. "Run." She jogged through the trees. Her breath rasped. She abandoned what she'd been feeling and thought only of the mark on the map and reaching it while it was still dark. It was the owl's hour, one last loop of the night, a final hunt before dawn crept in. Kestrel slowed. Her legs were jelly. She drank from the canteen strapped over one shoulder and across her chest, swished and spat. Her bad knee throbbed a little, but she realized, distantly, curiously, that her body had grown strong. The days of riding had hardened her legs. It felt good to run. But her strength also reminded her of her weakness, of how easily her body had given out on the tundra. The unlocking of the prison gate, relief, joy, then the chase, legs collapsing, mud, rope, the dress ripped open along her spine. Kestrel capped the canteen, screwed it. She ran again. The sky was dark blue when she saw a flicker of orange in the trees. An oil lamp. Her heart hit her ribs. She slowed her run, moving toward the clearing. The lamplight swung. She'd been heard. "Hail!" she tried to call as she threaded through the last copse of trees, her sides heaving. She had no breath. She coughed and tried again. "Hail, Emperor Lycian, General of Wolves, father of 100,000 children!" It was his military title, as well as his political one. Though the Emperor hadn't fought in a war since the conquest of Haran, He retained his rank as First General, the only person to whom her father must answer.
"Alice,"
called the voice from behind the uplifted lamp. "Stay back, sir."
"You sound strange."
Kestrel dug out the token.
"Catch!"
She flipped it into the air and heard the man snag it, or heard, rather, the nothingness of the coin not hitting Earth. The lamp moved closer. Kestrel couldn't see the features of the man who held it, only his tall, broad form as he approached. Kestrel coughed.
"No, please stay where you are, sir. I'm sick."
"Come to my tent, then, and report there. Rest."
"It's a disease. Something Eastern. The barbarians brought it. I might infect you."
The officer's boots came to a gritty halt.
"What kind of disease?"
"It starts with a cough."
Kestrel hoped it'd explain any difference in voice. "Then pustules. The sores weep. I hadn't realized that one of the wagons held bodies. I'd crept close to their camp and looked inside the supplies to see how well fortified they were."
It felt strange to speak in Valorian again. "The rebels mean to withstand a siege. They have plague bodies to launch over the walls of the Aerilith Manor. They'll infect us when we attack. They seem to be immune."
"You need a physician."
He sounded genuinely concerned.
"We can quarantine you."
"Please, let me continue to do what I can for our victory."
Kestrel conjured the ghost of her very young self as she spoke. She remembered that little girl, so eager to be her father's warrior. She spoke with that girl's voice.
"As long as I can stay on my feet, I can still scout. I want to. Let me bring glory to the Empire."
He hesitated, then said,
"The glory is yours,"
which were the traditional words offered when a soldier accepted a mission almost certain to end in death. The Valorian officer shifted in the shadows and was quiet. The sky appeared to grow a little lighter, but Kestrel told herself that it was her imagination, that the sky couldn't possibly do that in the span of 2 heartbeats. She was letting anxiety rule her.
"Your report, then,"
the officer said.
"Tell me their numbers."
1,000 soldiers. Maybe 1,500.
Roshar's force near Aerilith numbered nearly twice that amount.
"Components?"
"Little cavalry, mostly infantry."
"True."
"From the looks of it, young."
"True."
"Inexperienced."
"Not true."
"Light cannon and not many of them."
"True, unfortunately."
"Some tension between the Dakran and Hirani factions."
"Less than she'd expect."
"Tension over who should command."
"Not true. Not exactly." Sometimes, though, she caught the way the prince eyed Aran with pensive hesitancy, as if he secretly believed Aran to be a wholly other creature than human, that a day would come when Aran's skin would split, and whatever was lurking inside him would climb out. In fact, most people looked at him that way.
"Position,"
the officer asked.
"By now, they'll have reached the manor."
"Tell me about the formation of their units, their positions within the army."
Kestrel answered, relieved. He seemed to believe her. This was easier than she'd thought. She mixed her lies and truths, setting them down like planks of joined wood, sturdy enough to bear the weight of this man's trust. But when she stopped speaking, the silence lasted longer than it should have.
"Alice,"
said the officer,
"where are you from?"
She pretended to misunderstand the question.
"Sir, I came from the rebels' camp."
"That's not what I mean. Where are you from?"
Her confidence vanished. He suspected her. She didn't know anything of the scout's history. Kestrel had taken the token and the map and had left as quickly as she could. Carefully, Kestrel told the officer.
"I thought you already knew."
"Remind me."
The lamplight was strong enough that he'd see if she began to inch a hand toward her dagger. She stayed still. "Gambling," she told him.
"I'm a colonial girl."
The odds were with her. Almost all of Valoria was a colony.
"But from where, exactly?"
She coughed again, making the sound murky and wet, and tried to think.
"From here."
Scouts deployed in Hirani would have to know the language, ideally the terrain, too. The scout, Alice, had been young, Roshar had said. Green, to be so easily caught. If the general chose someone with little experience to gather intelligence on the army, It must be because she had advantages that outweighed her inexperience, such as familiarity with the country.
"I'm from here, too," the officer said softly.
"Yes, sir." Her heart sped.
"I spent my youth on a farm west of here."
He took a step closer. She held her ground. He wasn't close enough yet to see her clearly. She couldn't see him clearly. But she caught now the slight accent in his voice. She would have had a colonial accent, too, if her father hadn't ordered her tutors to hammer any sign of it from her voice. In Valorian, she possessed the voice of a capital courtier, polished and pure.
"I want my home back," the officer said.
"So do I." She kept her voice low, rough from coughing, but added a subtle lilt, just enough that he might think the accent had been there all along and that he'd somehow missed it.
"What are my orders?"
She tried to keep the question steady. Her pulse was relentless.
"Return to your post. I'll inform the general of your report."
"Yes, sir."
The words came out in a relieved rush.
"Not quite yet."
The officer set the lamp down on the forest floor and backed away.
"Pick up the lamp."
Dread mounted in her throat.
"Sir?"
"Pick up the lamp and show me your face."
"But..."
She swallowed.
"The infection."
"I want to see it. I'll keep my distance."
"The risk."
"Soldier, pick up the lamp. Show me your face."
"Trust me," she'd told Aaron. She remembered the strength in her voice and tried to summon that strength again. She thought, fleetingly, that this must be what memory was for, to rebuild yourself when you lose the pieces. Slowly, Kestrel walked toward the lamp. She kept her head down, though she didn't think he could see her face yet. She'd seen nothing of his during the moment after he'd set the lamp at his feet, just before he'd backed away. She closed one eye, an old trick her father had taught her for night fighting that involved torches or lamps. One eye adjusted to see by torchlight, one eye kept in reserve to see in total darkness if the light went out.
"I don't want anyone to see me," she told the officer. "The disease has ruined my face."
"Show me, now."
She grabbed the lamp and smashed it against a boulder. He swore. Her dagger was in her hand. She heard him draw his sword.
"I don't want to kill," she'd told Aaron long ago.
Even if she'd wanted to, she'd fail. She felt the memory of failure, of her father watching while she couldn't fight back, her arm sagging beneath the pressure of someone else's sword.
"Who are you?"
He advanced, his blade probing the shadows, darting, cautious, blind. His sight hadn't yet adjusted, but it would. The officer would capture her and bring her to the general's camp. There'd be questions. She'd be made to answer. Pressed, split open along her weakest lines. She thought of the prison, her twilight drug, mud and agony. She imagined her father's face as she was brought before him. She saw it in her memory, her future. She saw it right now. Pulse wild, stomach tight, she crouched to grasp a handful of soil. He heard her and turned. She flung the grit into his face.
"A dirty trick,"
she heard her father say.
"Dishonorable."
But dirty tricks were her specialty. She darted around the man, came up behind him and slid the dagger's tip into his back, just below the ribs.
"Which code do you use to communicate with the general? Tell me."
"Never."
She dug a little harder.
"I'll kill you."
He hooked a leg around hers and jerked hard. She toppled, hit the ground. She scrambled to get up and found a sword's point at her throat.
"My turn to ask questions."
The officer kicked the dagger from her hand. A bird sang. Morning was coming. Kestrel was dimly aware of this, and of the horse she had tethered and now would never untether. She imagined Aaron, who wouldn't be sleeping. He'd be watching the sky and the road. She felt the grass beneath his hand, damp with summer dew. Half sitting, half crouching, she backed shakily away from the sword. It followed. An axe-and-axe sword. She recognized the shorter blade, favored for fighting in forests. She shrank from it, felt a sharp rock dig into her back, and thought, oddly, of the piano. A whole passage burst into her mind, one that she hadn't played in years, but had loved for its dramatic swings from high to low registers. She had liked to cross her right hand over and drive the sound down into darkness. She didn't have to stretch hard. Although Kestrel was small, she had long hands, long arms, very good reach. She groped the forest floor behind her and curled her fingers around the jagged rock that poked into her back. She swung it, smashing the man's hand where he held the sword's hilt. He made a terrible sound. The sword fell. Its tip glanced off her thigh, slicing through her trousers. It struck the earth. Pain seared down her leg. But she was up. Her fisted rock crunched into the man's face. His head dented. Her fingers were greasy and warm. Liquid ran under the leather of her forearm guard. He thudded down. She dropped the rock. The birds were mad. There was a whole chorus of them now. Her thigh was hot, sticky. There was something meaty on her fingernails. Her hand was a glove of blood. "I don't want to kill," she had told Aaron. She slid into the memory and saw herself sitting in her music room across from Aaron. An open window sighed on its hinges. Warm autumn air, bite and sting tiles, all face up. Her hands were shaking. She was going to come apart. And if you do? Her plan was already in near ruins. Salvage the situation, then. Look at the body. Go on. Make certain he's dead. He was. Now yourself. Look. Kestrel peeled back the torn flap of cloth at her thigh. Blood seeped. It hurt, but she thought that maybe it wasn't too bad. Her leg could bear her weight. She wiped her bloody hand in the dirt. The tent, she told herself. Go. She walked unsteadily to the officer's small tent and entered. A pallet. A caged messenger hawk, hooded, sleeping. A stool set before a table that bore papers, a pen, an inkstand, and a set of counters. The papers. She went for them, snatching a page. Then she dropped it, her stomach roiling when she realized that it was a letter the dead man had been writing to his mother. "Keep looking," she told herself. "Forget his broken face." She examined each page in the small pile, searching for any scrap of a coded message between the officer and her father. Since the military used several different codes, she had to find evidence of which one the officer had been using. Maybe she'd recognize it. Remember, decode it. But there was no evidence, only the letter to his mother and blank pages. She limped back outside and saw, in the rising dawn, the man's crushed brow, the jelly of one eye. She swallowed hard, then searched the man and found his seal. Relief. The seal could be useful, but there was no coded message. She had hoped to try to fake a report from the officer to her father. An impossible thought. A stupid one. She didn't know the code, didn't even know the dead man's name. She wanted to bury her face in her hands. She returned to the tent and sank down onto the stool. Blood leaked from the cut on her leg. She should bandage it. She had no bandage. The hawk flexed its claws around its perch, shifting its weight with a scratchy, rustling sound. She glanced at it, feeling close to frustrated despair. Then her gaze fell to the counters. Beads of wood that slid along skinny steel rods in their wooden frame, used for accounting. Kestrel touched a bead. A memory unfolded inside her. She unscrewed the pot of ink and found a blank sheet of paper. Glancing at the officer's letter to his mother, Kestrel got a feel for how to imitate the man's handwriting. She inked her pen and composed the first line of code. 26. The horse trudged up the hill to the camp, its head hanging. The sun had climbed. It was near noon, and the day promised to be hot. It squeezed Kestrel's heart to hear the horse's breath. She'd ridden him too hard. But her left leg... The wound had stopped bleeding. The flap of her sliced trouser leg stuck to it, hardened with clotted blood. The cut stung, and the skin around it felt fiery. She was going to have to peel the fabric away to see what was underneath. The horse slowed and sighed. Kestrel didn't have it in her to force him forward. She shifted to dismount, then winced and stopped when the movement opened the cut along its edges. thirsty. The sun made her queasy. At the scout station, she'd splashed water from her canteen onto the wound. In the forest, when she'd untied the horse, she'd poured water into her palm for the animal to drink, and did it again until there was nothing left. Now she could see the pale peaks of tents along the rise of the hills. She was close. And really, her poor horse. She'd moved again to dismount when she heard her name. Aaron was coming down the steep hill, skidding on the grass in his haste, yet keeping his balance. A breeze tore through his hair, kited his shirt. His descent became a breakneck run, and Kestrel wondered wryly whether the god of death watched over him after all, or maybe the god of grace, or heights, or goats, or whatever god might allow Aaron to run like that, and not trip over a hillock and come tumbling down. It seemed a little unfair. He jogged up to her, his hair heavy with sweat. His skin had darkened on the trek south, but he seemed paler now as he looked up at her, shadows under his eyes. He hadn't slept. He noticed her hand first. Her left side was hidden from his view. It touched her, how his gaze went straight to her bloody right hand, his eyes flashing with the same thing she'd feel if her fingers were damaged, if she couldn't play and had to hobble along the piano keys when she wanted to fly. He stripped off her forearm guard, swearing at the straps. "That's not my blood," she said.
"You're not hurt."
"Left leg." He came around the horse, saw, and went quiet.
"All right," he said finally. "Come on."
He helped her down.
"I can carry you."
She heard the question in his tone.
"No, Rashar will see. He'll tease us mercilessly about it."
She smiled because she wanted Aaron to smile. She didn't like the way he looked, the drawn lines around his mouth, eyes hooded with worry. He didn't smile. He cupped her face with both hands. An emotion tugged at his expression, a dark awe, the kind saved for a wild storm that rends the sky, but doesn't ravage your existence, doesn't destroy everything you love. The one that lets you feel saved. Nervousness rose within her. It simmered, sickened. Unreasonable. She knew that she could lift her parched lips to his and taste the truth of his love on his tongue. Still, she couldn't say what she wasn't sure she felt. Her thigh throbbed.
"No carrying," she said lightly. "But I'll let you help me up the hill."
Leading the horse behind them, they moved slowly through the camp. Aaron's arm under Kestrel's shoulders. He brought her to his tent.
"I think,"
he hesitated,
"inside. You could stay outside, but..."
He glanced down at her bloody thigh.
"The trousers need to come off. I can fetch someone else."
"No, you."
His eyes flicked to hers, then away. She went inside the tent. There was no canvas floor, only grass and a bedroll. She sat on the ground. Aaron glanced at her dry mouth.
"You're thirsty," he said,
and laughed. He returned with a canteen, a bowl of water, a small pot, and clean gauze. She drank. The water seemed to fall down a long way inside her. She thought about the water, how amazing it felt to drink. She thought about that, and not him. Aaron knelt beside her. She set the canteen aside. The cut was a dull pain. Almost nothing in the wake of her heightening awareness of him, her rapid heart. Outside the tent, cicadas sang. He unbuckled her armor and lifted it gently away.
"Nowhere else?"
"Just my leg."
It was a relief at first to be out of armor, yet once it was gone she felt exposed and too soft. Aaron didn't move. She knew what she was supposed to do next. Her fingers fumbled. She reached to unfasten the fall of her trousers.
"Wait," Aaron said. "Just..."
He stopped, then continued.
"Leave them on."
He reached into the rent in the left trouser leg and ripped it open, carefully forcing the path of the rip to circle her thigh. Soon the cloth was almost entirely detached, save for the flap still stuck to the wound. He tipped water onto it to soften the fabric.
"This will hurt."
"Do it."
He peeled the flap from the wound. She sucked in air as blood ran. He pulled the cloth free, leaving her left leg almost entirely bare. He rinsed the wound.
"Ah,
what?"
Aaron lifted his dark head and smiled.
It's not so bad.
She glanced down at the blood.
I mean, he hastened to say, that you don't need stitches. Which is good. Not that it's not bad for you, or that it doesn't hurt, or...
She laughed. Aaron, I'm glad, too, that it's not worse. He began to clean it. Pinkish water ran down her leg. The ground beneath her grew damp. He blotted away blood with gauze, and it did hurt. Yet his touch was tender, and he was skilled at this, so that when he unscrewed the pot of whitish salve and began to dab it along the cut, she asked, "Did you learn this in battle?" His head remained bowed, and he kept his gaze on what he was doing.
"Some things. Others from books, or..."
He abruptly stopped. "Aaron?"
"Under Valorian rule, we learned to do what we could for ourselves, for others, when we were hurt."
"When they hurt you?" He shrugged, reaching for the roll of gauze. "I should have known. I shouldn't have asked."
"You can ask me anything."
The cream was cool and tingled. Her whole body relaxed with the absence of pain. He placed gauze on the wound and unwound the roll, wrapping it around her thigh. Her gaze followed the gauze as it circled her skin, came up between her legs and down again. His palm brushed her inner thigh, rough and warm. They fell into silence. Aaron came to the end of the gauze, which he threaded through its other layers and knotted to itself. He was done, yet didn't move. The heels of his hands were against her knee, palms flushed against her skin, fingertips skinning the gauze's lower border.
"Better?"
Her body felt lax and alive. She didn't want to answer him. If she did, his hands would slide away from her.
"Kestrel?"
"Yes," she said reluctantly. "It's better." He stayed still. Outside, cicadas ticked and buzzed. He met her gaze, his eyes in shadow. His fingers traced a pattern that had nothing to do with healing, and seemed to open her flesh in glowing lines. Her breath caught. He heard it, and rocked back onto his heels and stood, and crossed to the other side of the tent in one rapid motion before she could say anything. And then there was nothing, really, to say. Aaron sat near his bedroll.
"What happened at the scouts' station?"
Kestrel sank her hands into the leftover water at the bottom of the bowl. She rubbed at the bloody grime on her right hand, concentrating on it. That glowing feeling ebbed. "Inconvenient," she told it. "Problematic. Now, of all times. What is wrong with you, that you can't respect a friend who has asked not to be used? That everything sparks and burns at the hope of his temptation? That maybe he'll heed it, sink down into it, and it will comfort? It won't, not for him. Maybe not even for you." She washed her hands clean. Kestrel told Aaron everything from when she'd left camp last night to the moment when she drove a rock into the officer's face. "I killed him," she said, and would have said something else, yet faltered. Aaron frowned.
"You feel guilty?"
"He wasn't wearing armor." Aaron flicked an impatient hand.
"His mistake."
"He cared about me."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean Alice, the scout. He was concerned about her."
"Are you saying that you're sorry you killed him because he was a nice person?"
"I'm saying that he was a person, and he's dead, and I did it."
"I'm glad you did."
"I'm not." Now she was angry, too.
"Are you aware,"
Aaron's voice hardened,
"of what he would have done to you?"
"If he'd tried to kill me, he would have succeeded. He didn't want to. That's the only reason I was able..."
"He didn't want to kill you because he wanted to capture you."
"I know. I can know that and still feel sorry."
"Don't ask me to share your sentiment."
"I'm not."
"If he'd taken you..."
Aaron stopped, then said,
"They are murderers, slavers, thieves. I am not sorry. I will never be sorry."
"So you've never questioned the kill?" His eyes flashed, then looked haunted.
"I won't."
Kestrel searched his face, her anger fading with a reminder that their difficulties were different, and Aaron's own damage ran deep. Whether she meant to or not, she was probing into raw places. "I've upset you."
"Yes, I'm upset. It's upsetting to hear that you feel guilty for defending yourself against someone who would have hurt you."
There is more to it than that. He looked down at his hands, spotted with her blood.
You can change your mind. It's all right if you do. You don't have to be part of this war.
Yes, I do. My mind isn't changed.
It was him or you,
he said softly.
You had to choose.
Her gaze fell to the wet grass beneath her, the wrapped bandage. She thought of her past, her whole life.
I want better choices. Then we must make a world that has them.
When Roshar saw her ripped one-legged trousers and Arryn at her side as they stood outside the prince's tent, his eyes glinted with mirth, and Kestrel felt quite sure that the prince was going to say it was about time Arryn tore her clothes off. Then Roshar might comment coyly on Arryn's inability to reach a full conclusion.
Only one trouser leg,
she imagined Roshar saying.
How lazy of you, Arryn.
Or on the quaint quality of Arryn's modesty.
What a little lamb you are.
Perhaps he'd offer condolences to Kestrel on the partial death of her trousers. He'd ask whether she'd gotten injured on purpose. Kestrel flushed. Things at the scout station didn't go according to plan, she said, stating the obvious in order to shunt the conversation to where it should be. Not, absolutely not, about what had happened or didn't happen in Arryn's tent.
She's wounded, said Arryn,
who, although he didn't look it, must have also been flustered, if he too felt he had to state the obvious.
Barely, Roshar said. A mere scratch, or she wouldn't be standing. You could offer her a seat, Arryn said. Ah, but I have only two chairs in my tent, little Harani, and we are three. I suppose she could always sit on your lap.
Arryn shot him a look of deep annoyance and pushed inside the tent.
But I could have said something so much worse, Roshar protested.
Say nothing at all, Kestrel told him.
That would be very unlike me.
She ignored him. When the three of them were inside the prince's tent, Arryn chose to stand. She explained in detail what had happened. I wrote the letter to the general, she finished, and launched the hawk.
How many sets of codes do Valorian scout runners use? Roshar asked.
Kestrel dug her thumbnail into the teak arm of her chair. Many. I'm not sure exactly. I might not remember all of what my father taught me, or he could have chosen to teach me only some of them. New ones could have been created and put into use since then.
So the chances that the letter you wrote is the correct code, and will be the one the general expects to see, are slim.
Yes.
How did you choose which code to use? Arryn asked.
The officer had counters in his tent, which was unusual, unless he was in charge of accounting for the army's supplies, and that had to be done at the main camp, where supplies are kept. I remembered a numeric code. He could have been using counters to help him write in it.
Or, said Roshar, your father will read the note, see one code when he expects another, and will send someone to the station where there's a dead body. If so, Arryn said, then we're no worse off than we were before. Oh, yes, we are. The general will know the letter's a ploy, and will do the opposite of what we want. He'll ignore the main road. He'll take back roads through the forest, where our guns would be of dubious use, and we wouldn't have the advantage of height. You know this.
Arryn shut his mouth, glancing uneasily at Kestrel. Yes, he had known this, as had she. She felt worse for his effort to make her mistake seem smaller. He knew its true size. Roshar leaned back in his creaking chair. His eyes slid from Arryn to Kestrel, black as lacquer, the green lines around them fresh.
Can you tell me anything more cheerful than all this?
My letter mentions nothing about a plan to use plague bodies as a defensive attack during a siege. I had to say that to the officer to make him keep his distance. But once he was dead, that lie wasn't necessary. Now the manor can seem to be an even easier and more appealing target.
If your father takes the bait. She did what she could, Arryn said.
The numbing properties of the ointment on the cut in her thigh were wearing off. She rubbed at the bandage, studying its interleaving, and tried to swallow her sense of failure, which grew worse to hear Arryn defend her.
I know, Roshar said, but our force is small enough as it is. We can't be in two places at once. He's going to move on Aerilith. I don't want to fight a defensive battle. We can't afford it. If conflict happens here, we'd have the height of the hills, but they've got the numbers to fan out and flank us. What I liked about the plan of attacking them on the road was the chance to pen them in, to pin them down so that they can't move. Then trust her.
Kestrel glanced up at Aaron. Roshara said,
Sending that coded letter was a desperate gamble. It was her desperate gamble, Aaron said. That's why I think it will work.
They were to break camp at dawn. Kestrel watched Aaron disappear among the supply wagons. She went to the river, washed the blood and sweat from her, then changed the shredded trousers, which had been the scouts for the pair she'd worn when she'd ridden south. She did not think very much. She watched leaves bend in the wind and show their pale underbellies. There was the rushing water, the cicada's metallic rasp. She walked back to the center of camp. Aaron had set up a wet grinder and was, it seemed, going progressively through the spare arms stored in a wagon, inspecting each blade. He frowned at a sword and held it down at an angle to the grinder, setting its stone in motion. The sound was harsh. Then his gaze flicked up. He saw her, and the grinder stopped. She approached. There are Dacran smiths in this camp. Other people can do this.
Not well enough.
He spread oil on the blade to polish it. His fingers glistened.
I like doing it.
Aaron held out his oiled hand.
May I?
For a moment, she didn't understand what he wanted. Then she drew the dagger he'd made for her and gave it to him. Aaron looked it over, surprised, pleased.
You take good care of it.
She took it back. Of course I do. Her voice was rough and wrong. He peered at her. Friendly, he said.
Yes, of course. Is there a saying for it? A Valorian always polishes her blade. Something like that.
I take care of it, she said, suddenly both miserable and angry. Because you made it for me. She hadn't liked his surprise. She disliked herself for causing it, for the knitted confusion of her feelings, for the way she'd grown smaller to hear Aaron defend her to Roshar, not simply because of the force of her sense of failure, but also because she'd asked Aaron to trust her, and now he did, unwaveringly. Yet he'd asked her to love him, and she offered nothing. She swung between the solid certainty of attraction and the apprehension of more. I love you, she'd told her father. A plea, an apology, and also simply itself, 18 years of love. Was it really nothing, so worthless? Yes, it had been. She'd seen this when her father had lifted her clutching hands and pushed her away. She'd seen it in the dirt floor of her prison cell, heard it in the sound of her soiled dress ripped open along its back. She thought of the hawk, which must have winged its way to her father by now. She imagined it slewing around trees, dropping down, talons closing around his upraised fist, her father unrolling the coded message, the trap she'd set for him. Walk into it, she willed.
You have a mind for strategy, he'd said once.
Come see, then. See what I can do to you. See what you have done to me.
Kestrel.
Aaron's voice was hesitant. She realized how she must look, hand clenched on the dagger's hilt, a storm in her face. When he started to speak, she cut him off. Do you have more of that salve?
Oh.
He fumbled under the leather apron he wore over his clothes and pulled the small pot from his pocket.
I should have given it to you earlier. I was distracted. I forgot.
She took it and laughed. Usually she enjoyed her tent. It was private, which made her recall that she'd always felt watched before the prison. In the capital, certainly. Even in Harran, when it had been a colony, privacy was a relief. The circle of rough canvas cocooned her. It glowed or dimmed with the passage of the sun. Now, however, as she heard the noises of camp, people talking in two different languages, horses and birds and insects and the burr of the grinder, she felt as she had on the first day Aaron had pitched her tent. Lonely. Kestrel removed her trousers and unwrapped the bandage. It was damp and heavy from the river. The cut wasn't bleeding. It didn't hurt that much. She spread ointment onto the cut anyway. When it numbed, she thought of the prison's nighttime drug. Her chest throbbed with a slow pang. She missed the drink's taste and what it did to her. She painted the cream down her thigh where Aaron had touched her. The skin went numb. Kestrel bandaged herself again and tried to envision the morning when she'd break down her tent, break camp, and strike south to attack her father. 27. They split their forces once more. A contingent was sent to Aerolith's manor to make it look ready for a siege. If Kestrel's father trusted the coded note, he'd run scouts ahead to gather information on the manor. Rashar sent most of the supply wagons there. All of their cannons, too. A risk.
Fast and light.
He spoke as if this were an entertaining choice, and not a dangerous necessity to leave their main artillery behind. But stealth was necessary, as much as a small army could be stealthy. Speed was important, too, and the terrain was bad for hauling anything. They'd need to work their way south through the forest and up to the hills overlooking the main road.
I'm worried about the trees, Kestrel said to Rashar at the end of the first day of their move south.
Uriel birds hunted overhead, swirling into a black fingerprint against the violet sky. Kestrel flicked a playing card to the grass. A rabbit was roasting on a spit over the nearby fire, its skin a crackled brown. Aaron slid a knife into it, separating the flesh. Too pink. He added sticks of resinous siren wood to the fire. They caught instantly, blazing blue.
Worried, how?
Rashar glanced at his cards and groaned. But Aaron, who'd been watching their game without taking part, had already guessed what Kestrel was thinking.
We need the trees for cover, he said. But they'll make it hard to use the guns. We won't have much hope of hitting targets on the road below.
Better cut them down, Rashar took his turn. The wood's undergrowth might be enough to screen us if we lie low.
Kestrel clicked her teeth, an eastern, irritated sort of sound.
You learned that from me, the prince said, pleased. Now tell the truth. Did you mark the cards?
Coolly, she said. I never cheat.
We can't cut the trees down, Aaron said.
Concentrate, Kestrel told the prince, sweeping up the card he'd tossed down.
To be clear, I'm letting you win. I let you win all the time.
Obviously, we can't cut them down, she said. My father will notice a sudden swath of felled trees. We might as well paint a sign telling him we're there.
Or, Aaron said.
She glanced at him. What are you thinking?
How much rope do we have?
212 lengths, Rashar said.
You've been going over our supplies.
Yes, she said.
Could you rattle off the units by heart?
Yes.
How many sacks of grain for horses?
62. Play your card. You might as well. You're going to lose regardless.
Attempts to distract her usually don't work, Aaron told him.
You play the winner then, Rashar said, so that I may observe your technique.
Aaron checked the rabbit again, pulled it off the fire.
No.
A surprised disappointment twitched, insect-like, inside Kestrel's chest.
Rashar said, Why not?
Aaron sliced meat off the bone onto a tin plate. Kestrel, who wasn't entirely sure she wanted to hear Aaron's answer, said, Why do you want rope?
Let Aaron surprise us, Rashar said. That's how we do things. He comes up with something brilliant, and I take the credit.
Tell me, Kestrel said. Aaron set down the plate.
I won't play you because even when I win, I lose. It's never been just a game between us.
Rashar, who was stretched out on his side on the grass, elbow crooked, cheek pillowed on his palm, raised his brows at Kestrel.
I meant about the rope, she muttered.
Rashar's gaze slid between her and Aaron.
Yes, the rope. Why don't we talk about that after all, shall we?
They were in position. Kestrel waited with the gunners behind a thin layer of trees bordering a hill that overlooked the road. A breeze flipped the leaves. Trees creaked. The gunners, mostly Harani, nervously looked up at Aaron's project. It had taken nearly all the soldiers the better part of the day, using two-handed saws from the supply wagon. Axes, too. And, of course, the rope. Arryn had tied each tree trunk and staked the rope deep down into the forest floor. Each tree was unique, its height and width and lean calling for a different network of ropes set at different angles. After the trees had been tied into place, soldiers sawed them at their base, though not quite all the way through.
"When the Valorians come," Arryn had said, "cut the ropes."
"You want to kill me," Rashar had said. "Embarrassingly, a prince meets his end in battle. He doesn't get squashed by a falling tree. I bet you tied those things all wrong."
A smile tugged at the corner of Arryn's mouth. The air was gritty with sawdust.
"After everything," he told Kestrel, "I wouldn't let you be harmed by a tree."
"Me," Rashar said pointedly.
"You mean me."
But Arryn had already gone. Soon after, Rashar left in the opposite direction. The plan was an ambush.
"What formation would the general use," Rashar had asked her, "for a march along a road of that width?"
Kestrel had paused, fingers on the worn map.
"She can't know for certain," Arryn said.
"Here's what I would do if I were him," she said. "I'd be in the front ranks, where I'd keep most of my cavalry, the officers. New recruits would be behind the supply wagons, which I'd keep in the middle, infantry in the back with a few trusted officers, just in case. I'd choose officers who wouldn't complain about being in the rear guard with the lower ranks. They'd be experienced, they'd be good, but there'd be few. Archers and crossbows flanking the regiment, ready to target the hills. He'll know there's a risk of a skirmish. It'd make sense, if we were readying for a siege at Aralith, to send small groups to harass their progress north. He'd expect the supplies to be targeted. If we destroy the wagons, we cut the legs out from under him. It's not that an attack would be a complete surprise. It's the force of our attack, and our ability to use a weapon he can't contend with, that give us our best advantages."
"So we give him what he expects," Arryn said. "A small company of ours can attack the front lines, draw the general's attention while our larger force prepares to bucket the rear guard. The general should pull his defenses forward. We might even separate them from the center. Their officers wear metal armor. Volleys from the guns will be more effective on the center and rear. The gunners should drop as many soldiers as possible around the wagons. And, gods help us, the cannons."
"A small company attacking the Valorians' front ranks," Rashar mused. "How delightfully suicidal. Perfect for you, Arryn."
"But," said Kestrel. They both looked at her, and she could tell from the set of Arryn's jaw that Rashar had said only what Arryn already planned to do anyway. Arryn's eyes were overcast. They had a distant, difficult regard that sent a chill down her spine. It made her wonder whether Arryn's god was real after all. If he was there right now inside Arryn, whispering to him.
"You command this force," Kestrel told Rashar. "It should be you. Arryn can attack the rear guard."
With a smirk, Rashar said,
"No, that pleasant task is mine. You, little ghost, stay with the guns."
Kestrel's fingers tightened.
"You're placing me in the safest position."
"I'm placing you where you won't be seen by your father."
She thought of the general seeing her. She thought of him not seeing her. Both thoughts were paralyzing.
"You're not so different from one of those guns," Rashar said. "A secret weapon. The general must know you've escaped the work camp, must guess where you went, if you survived the tundra. But will he think you're here, with this army?" "He might, eventually. He might recognize your hand in these dealings, whether he sees you or not. But I would rather, and I'm sure Arryn would very much rather, that he have no confirmation of your presence."
She started to protest.
"You swore an oath to me," Rashar said cheerfully. "A Valorian honors her word."
Seeing that his last words made her pale with fury, he grinned and laughed.
"You want me with the guns, too," Kestrel told Arryn.
"Rashar's not wrong."
"He's choosing according to his own best interests."
His brow furrowed.
"Positioning you with the guns gains him little, personally."
"What about your position against the general's forward ranks?"
"Sometimes Rashar plays the selfish prince so that no one expects anything better of him. It's not who he is. He's choosing well. For me, he's chosen what I would have chosen for myself. I want the front lines.
Kestrel remembered Arryn's words now as she waited in the trees with the gunners who'd been placed under her command. She remembered how she'd wanted to explain to him.